Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
My name is Daisuke Miao. I'm a professor of film studies at the University of California, San Diego.
And Daisuke, I think we met probably 25 years ago, maybe more. And
Yeah, that was 1995 when
1995, so nearly 30 years.
I
And I have
almost
to
30
say,
years.
it's an incredible privilege to see you, to talk to you, and for us to record this podcast episode together. So thank you very much, my old friend.
Thank you, Toby. It is a great honor for me to talk with you like this. I still remember the pleasurable impact or surprise that I had when I received the course syllabus. I mean, you are my first teacher at NYU Cinema Studies, and I still remember the time when I received your course syllabus, which is for the Introduction to Graduate Studies in Cinema Studies. And it's like 50 page. Double, not double space, double page. And it's a huge list of readings, essential books, articles in cinema studies. And I was very excited to get familiarize myself with, with those readings. But at the same time, I was really overwhelmed. So this invitation coming from you, it means a huge, huge. And it means a lot to me. Thank you, Toby.
Thank you. So, first question, and this is a 2024 question, not a 1995 question, but actually, we could just as easily go back and ask the same question then, couldn't we? Which is to inquire if you would share with us, Daisuke, what are the things that are currently impelling you, dynamizing you, preoccupying you, interesting?
There are so many things that I am thinking of these days, but probably the most significant issue that I have been thinking about is the issues of communication. Communication breakdown is happening in various places. The most imminent one is between, I think, our students and the people in academia. So, yes, I am teaching courses on films, Japanese films, silent films. But of course, the content is very important, historical specificity, the context of film production, film exhibition, so on and so forth. But I really want my students to learn how to communicate. So, various languages, how to read film languages, visual languages. That's very important. But at the same time, I do want them to express their thoughts, their ideas, their uniqueness, original ideas in a very understandable ways. So I do want them to talk about them, their ideas in a way that people can understand. So the issues of communication, I think, is the most important issue to me right now.
And is that a question of communication breakdown between faculty and students?
That's one, most immediate example, for my daily life. But the question is, of course, bigger, right? The communication breakdown between, let's say, the government and the people, between the nations, between generations. I kind of, notice such discrepancy, gaps in various levels in the current world. So, but it's really hard to do things in a on a bigger scale. I mean, as a person, as a small person. So what I can do as a scholar of film studies, teaching Japanese films or silent films, what I can do is to talk with students. That's what I'm doing.
But this is something you're noticing at every level of society and across the globe. Is that right? A problem of communication. And in your many decades of teaching, which you've done in Oregon in the United States, in San Diego in the United States. You've just been in Lyon in France and other countries as well. You're seeing a change at the pedagogic level. Is that right?
Yes, I think so. Yes, I think so. I am originally from Japan. So I was born and raised in Japan before I moved to the United States in 1995. So my first 20 some years were spent in
Right.
Japan. And speaking specifically about academia, I felt some kind of uneasiness in film studies in Japan, which was not really about let's say the focus was not really on the historical analysis of films. It's more about the text per se. One of the most influential professors in Japan, he was kind of promoting a so-called surface analysis or surface criticism. So just focus on what we can see on the screen.
Yeah.
And he didn't really talk about why those images are on the screen. You know, we need to focus on the details of the images, which we can see in mise-en-scène. I think that was a great training for me to focus on, you know, the details for textual analysis. But I was really, frustrated, unsatisfied with not talking about why, how, you know, those things came onto the screen. So that was perhaps the first communication breakdown or the communication that I want to make happen in studying films then.
Yeah, right. Because that material nature of what's actually on screen, the images and the music, the words, etc., that's terribly important, but these things don't happen in a vacuum.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
So,
there are cultural contexts of production and reception, and there's a political economy that allows these things to happen or doesn't, I guess, right? And the problem for me many times is that there's a divorce that's very rigid between these approaches. So institutional approach people attack textual analysts. Textual analysts are not interested in what institutional approaches are. I mean, film studies does this much better than literary studies, where there's barely any institutional analysis. So it's there in film studies, it seems to me, but it's held back somehow. There's no real intermarriage at a professional level. And I think one of the things about your work is that you give us that, actually.
Thank you. Thank you. I tried, partially because, well, maybe mainly because, this frustration about surface criticism was the big reason why I moved to the United States and the US academia. I thought that cinema studies in the United States, especially NYU cinema studies, I thought, the program would provide me with an opportunity to integrate, textual analysis and contextual analysis, so to speak. So, in a fruitful manner. And, well, in the end, yes, it did. But what I witnessed when I moved to NYU Cinema Studies was, yeah, as you said, some kind of a, debate or discrepancy or strong communication. I really enjoyed that. But at the same time, it might have been a communication breakdown as well. Some scholars were focusing on textual analysis, and some scholars were, more and more focused on the background issues of political economy. And so that was a tension I missed. I could say when I experienced when I initially came to the United States. Cinema studies. So, but this communication, that's what I started to learn from your seminar at the graduate studies in cinema studies. You focused on theory first and then history throughout the course. So I started thinking about how to, integrate the two throughout that seminar.
Now, you've written and edited several books I can't help but start with what's the latest one that I have in my possession. I don't know if it's your latest one, but the latest one I have, which is 2019. Oh, well, actually, sorry, there's the 2020 book, which is about Japan,
Japanese.
cinema, Japanese. But I want to go back 1 year to 2019. 2020 is Japanese, right? 2019 and cinema is a cat. A cat is cinema. As I was saying before we started recording, I think the last time I saw you, you'd maybe just finished writing this book. And I thought, he's gone crazy. I don't understand. He's one of the most rigorous, brilliant scholars I know. He's writing a damn book about a cat. And of course, I love cats, but I didn't get it. Anyway, now that I've read it, I do. Could you justify yourself, sir? Could you explain to us why cinema is a cat and cats are cinema?
Well, the biggest justification is that I love both, cinema and cats.
It's all about
Through,
you.
throughout my career, I was thinking about, what I could do to combine the two or connect the two. So that's the biggest justification. Another justification is, I have also been thinking about, how we can connect the academia to the real world. I mean,
Right.
the general readers who are interested in films. I thought maybe cat, feline friends might be a guide to do that. There are a lot of people who are really invested in, cats and the lives of cats, and there are people who are interested in cinema, but don't have, the language to talk about films. So perhaps, and there are so many films about cats or the cats in which cats appear, Godfather, some Lumiere cinema, Edison films, Alien, so on and so forth. So it might be I thought it might be a great idea to go through the history of cinema, in which cat appears, to see, the important concepts of film theory, film languages. That might be an interesting book to introduce film studies to cat lovers, or vice versa, film lovers to cat studies. So yeah, that's the second, justification. The third justification might be, I am also interested in so-called animal studies these days. The beyond the human perspective, it is important to see the world from a non-human perspective. So throughout the book, I'm using this term, cat's gaze, or the cat's perspective. So in that regard, this book is also, ecocritical work about the contemporary world. So those are the three justifications, perhaps, to write this book.
One of the ways, I think it's University of Hawaii Press, is that right? One of the ways in which they promote the book, and I think it's true, and it connects to what you just said, is that you're endeavoring to make film theory something approachable, something usable, and not something that is intimidatory. And so locating this in our everyday lives as cat lovers helps to enable that. Have I got that right?
Thank you for summarizing the concept behind the book. Yes. I don't want film studies to be the area just for scholars. My yeah, second what was that my first justification? No, the second justification. I really want, this communication to happen as well, the communication between academia and general readers, or the ordinary people who are interested in, intellectual thinking or writings, but can't find ways to start that. So as a film scholar who are really interested in this, communication between the two communities, I wanted to do something, and in a way, our cats, you know, paved the way for me, for us to start this. So in that regard, you know, I really appreciate, you know, the thoughts that I was able to come up with our cats.
And what is your latest book? I think the Japanese book. Moving on to that, this is both an instantiation of the conventions of film history, because you start with the Brabus Lumière in Lyon, where you had a sabbatical, where you've just been teaching last week, you were telling me. But it's a challenge because it also allows Japan to be one of the points of origin of cinema. Not simply as it has been taught for decades, as one of the first important cinemas, one of the foundational places for art cinema in inverted commas, but actually as one of the points of origin of the very art and industry, right? In the 19th century and just after. And I wondered if you could tell us about that provocation, that notion of Japan as a point of origin.
Again, the issues of communication are behind this book. There are two, I think. One issue of communication behind this book is the discrepancy between nations or countries when we talk about film studies. There was a problematic concept, you know, national cinema for a long time, and many films are considered to be a national product. And let's say when, you know, Kurosawa films or Ozu films were discussed, they were strongly connected to the idea of Japanese national culture or something like that. To me, the history of cinema is a global network from the very beginning. So, yes, there were political times in which, you know, a nation played a significant role to formulate or to produce films. Well, for example, the war propaganda films during World War II in Japan or in the United States, you know, the notion of national cinema was very important in those days. But at the same time, if we think about styles, technologies, techniques, you know, there have always been a global network, you know, corporations, collaborations. So I really wanted to, foreground or emphasize this connection or network in terms of art history, cinematography, and so on and so forth. So Japanese book, one communication that I wanted to create is this global network of film technology. The second communication that I wanted to point out in this book is specifically about cinematography. Another gap that I have been witnessing in film or film culture is the gap or the discrepancy between film studies and filmmaking practice. I don't want to, you know, call NYU a bad example, but there are two, you know, departments, film and TV and cinema studies. You know, there are two departments, right? I don't understand why, you know, the study of cinema needs to be in two separate departments. I wanted, you know, more communications to occur between those two departments. So filmmakers, I'm sure that they learn a lot from the study of cinema, no matter how theoretical they can be, you know, psychoanalysis or semiotics. At the same time, cinema scholars, I think it is more and more important and interesting to learn about the practices of filmmaking. And cinematography was one area that I have always been interested in. And so I talked with lots of cinematographers. I dig into the, you know, the films, I mean, cinematography journals. I looked into the lives of Lumière cinematographers who went to Japan, traveled all over the world. So this is another communication that I wanted to make. Theory and practice, study and filmmaking.
Now, speaking of Japaneseness, Daisuke, Prof, I wanted to take us back 30 years and contrast that with today. Because one of the things that I think I'm seeing is today there's a moral panic in the United States and elsewhere about China. This reminds me of the moral panic about Japan 30 years ago. The fear of Sony taking over Columbia Pictures. Fear of Japanese money buying the Seattle Mariners in baseball. The fear of a Japanese economy as potentially overtaking the US. And I wonder what it was like for you as a Japanese person arriving in the United States at what I perceived as a time of deep-seated racism and anxiety directed at Japan.
To be honest with you, I was kind of torn between the two. I think there was a long history of how to represent Japan. I mean, there's a long history in the United States, for example, to how to represent Japan for, let's say, popular audience, right? One is, yes, like Rising Sun, you know, it's a fear, or the Yellow Peril, you know, scary entity, feudalism, militarism, you know, which led to World War II. Oppenheimer is one example of these days, you know, representation of it. The other is Japanism that I, you know, dealt with in my recent book. Adoration, it might be exoticism, but desire, liking of the sophisticated culture from non-West. So this combination between fear and adoration, you know, it always existed throughout the history of, let's say, 19th century to the 20th century. Maybe now as well, you know, manga, anime, games, you know, they are very attractive to the younger generation of audience. But at the same time, in in conjunction with this image of China, Asia still has a certain, you know, exotic element, like Shogun, you know, the TV series, so on and so forth. There is a historical specificity in this new series, but still, you know, there is exoticism in it, right? So when I came to the United States in the 1990s, I also felt, you know, this tension between adoration and mysteriousness, right? So to a certain degree, I must say I had to cater to, you know, the exoticism or expectation. So in a way, I played the role of model minority, so to speak. But at the same time, I really wanted to not correct, but communicate with people who are not really familiar with, you know, the global thinking or the culture of network negotiation, to speak about, not just for the Japanese culture, but for, you know, the global thinking, right? So that's what I tried to do, especially when I arrived in the United States.
No, I appreciate that frankness very much. You've also edited as well as written books, and you produced, along with your authors, a really path-breaking volume for Oxford about Japanese cinema. And I wonder if you could share with us some of your experiences of editing, how you conceive of a massive concept like Japanese cinema, how you recruit authors, and what it's like dealing with their submissions, producing a congruent text that makes sense, and so on.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Toby. The Oxford Handbook of Japanese Cinema is not really a book about Japanese cinema. It's not a, you know, orthodox film, I mean, book about Japanese cinema. Because, you know, I have, as I have stressed, I'm not really a believer of national cinema per se. So when Oxford came to me and asked if I'm interested in editing this volume, I said, if it is not a book just about and just for Japanese cinema, I am interested in doing that. So what I really wanted to do was to question what Japanese cinema is in the end, I really wanted to ask a question: what is Japan, right, in this book? So I didn't really ask only to the Japanese film specialists to contribute. So contributors are really diverse. So I asked film studies scholars, I asked film producer, I actually asked some filmmakers to contribute. They were too busy, so unfortunately, I was not able to include their pieces. But in the end, I wanted to make this book as comprehensive as possible to question the notion of national cinema and the nation itself.
And one of the issues in all of this is the hegemony of English as a language. And whilst that's not totally exclusionary in the sciences, where Japanese or Chinese or Hungarian biologists and ethnobotanists are quite used to reading and writing in English,
Yes.
it can be very exclusionary in the social sciences and the humanities, where there are lots of great journals in languages other than English and have been for decades, and where the absolute hegemony is not established, but it's en route. It's on the way. It's getting there. And I worry very much about what happens when, almost inevitably, as editors or authors, we restrict knowledge to what's been translated or to people who can write in English. I wonder if you've got any views on that, in part in the context of editing the book, but in general terms.
Yes. Cross-reading, what is happening in, let's say, if I talk about Japanese cinema, the area of Japanese cinema, I think cross-reading is very fruitful and important. So what is happening in Japanese academia about Japanese cinema, and what is happening in English language academia, it's happening in about Japanese cinema in, English language academia, to create, once again, the communication between the two is very important, especially when, those who are working just in Japan, they are not really, as you said, capable of writing or making a presentation in English. So yes, translation might have been the first, gateway for them to present their work to the English speaking academia. But at the same time, scholars who can do both, they should create a bridge or critical readings of the two, so that the people who are not familiar with, the non-English speaking academia can go to, I mean, become interested in what is going on. I mean, beyond the area or scope of the English-speaking academia. So, in that regard, yeah, I have included some work in translation, I mean, from Japanese to English in the Oxford Handbook. But at the same time, I asked contributors to use both, the background of American academic writings of Japanese cinema at the same time as Japanese, scholars work in Japanese to create, to formulate their articles.
Of course, in addition to there being linguistic differences, there are other aesthetic and stylistic ones. And you've also produced an important book about, in part, the idea of the shadow. I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about that.
Aesthetics of Shadow is a perhaps my most archival oriented book, because I dig into so many journals, so many magazines, newspapers in non-English languages, not just Japanese, but some European languages as well, because I wanted to explore the way to reread the history of cinema from the perspective of lighting and cinematography. So multiple levels of communication, I was aiming at. So filmmaking and film theory, Japanese and non-Japanese, and so on and so forth. And Speaking of the language, yes. There were, speaking of cinematographers, they were not really concerned about the national boundaries. They were more concerned about what would be the best way to capture the world by the camera. So, for example, Japanese cinematographers of the 1930s, they were at the same time as, attracted to the low-key cinematography in Hollywood, Marlene Dietrich, Lee Gams, Joseph von Sternberg, but at the same time, they were also adopting the work of German cinematography, mountain films, and Richard Angst, the German cinematographer, was one of the idols of Japanese cinematographers back then. So they were global thinkers. And when we just look at the Japanese, war propaganda films of the late 1930s, we don't really feel that. But there were, multiple levels of network of cinematographers and cinematography there. Even during the wartime, there was a cinematographer whose name was Harry Mimura, who studied his work in Hollywood with George Burns, the cinematographer for Rebecca Hitchcock, and Greg Toland, Citizen Kane. Toland was Mimura's co-worker with under George Burns. So when Mimura was making, nationalistic film in Japan in the 1940s, especially after the attack of Pearl Harbor, he was also thinking about what Greg Toland was doing in the United States with Orson Welles. So even, being separated by the war policy of the Japanese government and the US government, they were sort of, communicating about the focus cinematography throughout the 1940s.
I think this is one of the things we need to bear in mind, that there is always a relative autonomy of art. Sometimes it is strong, sometimes it's not. But people who are artists, as workers in all sorts of different fields, find ways often to communicate despite huge political, economic, or cultural differences, such as the war. And actually, you mentioned the Oppenheimer story earlier. I'm interested in your take on the film Oppenheimer and also its uptake in Japan, because I've read a couple of different accounts of how it was promoted there and received.
First thing that I must say is a complicated political relationship, especially during the post-war period in Japan. Do you know who shot the first film in Hiroshima after the bombing? It's the US Air Force, but the actual cinematographer was a Japanese guy whom I just mentioned, Harry Mimura.
Harry Mimura, really.
He was from Hiroshima. So he had a strong attachment to what happened to Hiroshima. But because of his experience in Hollywood before the war, because of his capacity of as a cinematographer and an English speaker, he was hired by the US Air Force to shoot a documentary film about Hiroshima after the bombing. So, this kind of story was never told in Oppenheimer. And even the scene of Hiroshima was not shown in the film. Oppenheimer's close-up instead, right? There were so many multiple levels of complication of political economy around the story of Oppenheimer as well.
That's a remarkable piece of background that I wasn't aware of, and I very much thank you for sharing it with us. And when Oppenheimer was brought before the government to justify why he should be allowed to continue with his high security clearance in the mid-50s, pardon me, one of the questions he was asked was why it was that all these physicists, atomic physicists, involved in the Manhattan Project, who were on the left, they were Marxists, why they were prepared to go ahead with, and of course this language wasn't used, this extraordinary infraction of human rights. Of course, no one talks about the firebombing of Tokyo or the bombing of Dresden, which was, I mean, the firebombing of Tokyo in many ways more destructive, or at least as destructive, in, if in a different form, yeah?
Yes.
But he said, we were, and you probably know this quotation, Prof, we were caught up in the, what he called the technically sweet. Suddenly, we had the means to see whether our theories would work, and we suspended our Marxist humanism because we wanted to play with the toys of money and power. So they just stopped thinking about what they knew would be the target, innocent Japanese people, and how this would have an inter and intra-generational effect. It's an extraordinary story about US imperialism and the role of the technocracy in it. And it remains really, along with slavery and dispossession, the dark spot in US imperial history for many of us in ways that are still not really engaged, still not really addressed, at least from my perspective.
Right. It's not just, I totally agree with you, Toby. And it's not just about international politics either, right? Especially when we think about the Cold War internal, I mean, domestic politics in the United States. We can also point out the tension between the Hollywood film industry and the U.S. federal government, right? It was almost the same time as McCarthyism and blacklisting of Hollywood. So Dalton Trumbo, you know, the film was released, you know, several years ago. But I, you know, when I was watching Oppenheimer, I was also thinking about, you know, what happened to people like Dalton Trumbo in Hollywood. So it's connected, I think.
And it also relates, I think, to what you talked about performing, being a model minority. Most listeners to the podcast, Prof, are outside the United States and outside Asia. So the plurality is in the US, depending on the week, between 30 and 40%. And then it's about 20% in Britain, about 10 to 12% in each of Spain, Australia, Latin America, and then smaller numbers in Asia and Africa. So the audience may have lots of knowledge of these events during the war or not, and they may have knowledge from different perspectives. But one thing that people may not know is that there were Japanese people in the United States in the 19th century, that they helped to build the railways that connected the country, that they were interned during the Second World War by a supposedly liberal governor, Earl Warren, who became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, that they were pilloried because of their supposed connections to the brutality of war. And so when you arrived in the United States 50 years later, that heritage, along with what we were discussing earlier, the threat of Japanese economic power, I would say urged you to be a model minority. Now, you can tell me I'm wrong, tell me I'm right, tell me I'm half right.
That's a very difficult question to answer. However, in retrospect, my dissertation, which turned into my first book, which was about Sesu Hayakawa, the first Asian matinee idol, was superstar in Hollywood in the 19-teens and 1920s. I might have thinking about how we can think about the image of Japan and how the Japanese people, Japanese immigrant, lived through the early the history of early 20th century, impacted me, you know, unconsciously. So Of course, the films that Hayakawa appeared in, films like The Cheat, they are very important in the stylistic history of cinema as well. But at the same time, I was thinking about the minority issues, the history of the American immigration and immigration politics. All those things are consciously, subconsciously, influencing me to dig deeper into the history of Japanese people in Hollywood in those eras.
Pardon me. And I wonder if we might talk about that first book.
Yes.
I can remember reading something you wrote about him all those years ago.
Yes. That was
And
the first paper that I wrote, the textual analysis of The Cheat.
yeah.
That's the midterm paper that I submitted to your class.
I still remember reading it and I thought, wow, this is fascinating and I don't know anything about this. But take us through the book because it's a very important contribution to knowledge. So in that book, what were you seeking to do? What did you establish for us?
So the first question that I had was why a Japanese person could become a superstar
Right.
in California in when and where the anti-Japanese sentiment was already happening in the late 19-teens to the 1920s. So this why question was the biggest one for me to write about. But at the same time, I wanted to. Perhaps I was also attracted to the cinematographic styles in which Hayakawa and his films contributed or applied to their films, so that the languages of film was formulated around the image of Asia or Japan as well. So the history of silent cinema is not just about D.W. Griffith or whiteness in Hollywood, but it's a collaboration of images or technologies between this, white America and Asia, and of course, African American history, right? So perhaps I was also thinking about, or I wanted to think about the multi-ethnic, multi-racial forming of the Hollywood film industry. That was one, aspect that French film critics, French film theorists, were, strongly intrigued by. They watched Hayakawa films like The Cheat and, formulated some theories like photogeny, in the 1920s, and they applied those ideas to, French filmmaking in the 1930s. And Hayakawa actually moved from, Hollywood to France in the 1930s and spent the whole wartime, I mean, from 19 up to 1945 in France, not going back to Japan. He was a star in France in the 1940s. So.
One of the moments in François Truffaut's book with and about Hitchcock is where somebody says to Hitchcock in his mythological self-narration, "How can you stand being in Hollywood? There are all those Americans." And he replies something along the lines of, and you'll remember this, "I haven't met any in Hollywood." Because it was full of people from all over the world.
Right,
Not in positions of decision-making executive power, although some of those were migrants from Russia, but in terms of cinematographers, screenwriters, actors, many of whom adopted English names but had no background in Englishness whatsoever. And of course, there were Chinese, Japanese, Indian origin people who were some of the key participants in the formation of Hollywood. So I think it's very important to bear that in mind. Prof, I've got two more questions for you, if I may,
Of
and
course.
then I'd like to throw to you to add anything you might wish to what we've already said as a way of concluding. Is that okay?
Of course.
So my first question is, to ask you a little bit about method and theory. So the method part is, how do you go about finding things out? And the theory part is, what are the main theoretical influences on you?
Method part, sometimes it's accidental. In the case of my most recent book, Japanism and The Birth of Cinema, I didn't really think about writing that book until I went to Lyon, France. So I spent my sabbatical year from 2012 to 13 in Lyon. Of course, I knew that Lyon was the place where the Lumiere brothers shot their first films. That attracted me a lot when I decided to go there. But that, you know, that year was right after my second book, The Aesthetics of Shadow, was published. So I didn't want to be honest, I didn't want to do anything, you know. I just wanted to take a rest and, you know, expose myself to new things that might be inspiring me. So I didn't really plan to do anything. But I, you know, I started to go to the Institut Lumière to see some films by Lumière brothers, and I was just hooked. First by the composition, you know, aesthetic elements that the cinema by Lumière brothers adopted. And I also thought about the connection, you know, the media archaeological connections between the Lumière cinema and other cultural artifacts like paintings and so on and so forth. So media archaeology, you know, came to me by watching lots of Lumière films in Lyon. So, I seriously started thinking about media archaeology as my methodology there. And so it came to me somewhat accidentally. Speaking of theory, the most impactful theories or theoretical thinking that I have is, of course, I must say, Edward Said and Orientalism. When I first read the book by Said, when I was a graduate student in Japan, I was just, you know, blown away. I didn't really think about exoticism or representation of non-Western or non-European people in such a, you know, a political, historical way. At all. So that is the basis of my thinking to this day, how I can re-articulate Said's Orientalism from the film studies and Japanese studies perspective, or the global perspective that is always in my mind.
Beautiful. Thank you. So, Prof, my last question before throwing to you to conclude is to ask, what's next? What's the thing you're working on now or thinking of working on?
There are several projects that I have been working on. One of them is just complete. New York, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Los Angeles, and lastly, Tokyo. They are doing events about the Benshi, the Japanese lecturers over silent cinema. So Japan has a very unique history about film exhibition. There were people who called themselves the Benshi or the lecturer who explain what is going on the screen. I mean, the stories and the background and so forth. So there were narrators accompanying the film image up to the 1930 something. So not just during the high day of silent cinema, but up to the 1930s. So the series, this event is to, you know, reconstruct or refurbish, you know, this interesting history of cinema or early cinema in Japan, the Benshi. And the catalog of the events, that is edited by myself and Professor Michael Emelich of UCLA. So it is coming out this April. So that's one thing.
Wonderful.
that I have been working on for a while. It's a rearticulation of the history of early cinema in Japan from a global perspective. Another work that I have been working on now is a book on Ozu, Yasujirō Ozu. Again, you know, I don't want to write this book from a perspective of national cinema or auteurism per se. So I'm not really, you know, creating a book about the masterpieces of Ozu films. It's more about how to study cinema with Ozu. So it's a very personal book, so to speak. I am working about the meanings of cinema or what cinema is as an entity together with what Ozu did in his work. So it's a collaboration between me and the US academia and Japanese academia and Ozu about cinema.
Fantastic. So to conclude, Prof, I wonder if there's something you'd like to add to what we've already discussed. It might be something additional to a topic we've mentioned, or it might be something entirely different.
I just want to thank you, Toby, as the first mentor, one of the first mentors for me to dive into the, you know, vast, huge ocean of film and media studies. Without your seminar, I didn't really think about transnationalism. That's another seminar that I took with you at NYU. That was the time when I started thinking about what this term trans means, you know, about transnationalism. And I still don't find a correct or exact answer about, you know, this trans. I don't really want to use the term transnationalism easily because, you know, it may not mean anything. But at the same time, there should be ways to productively use this term trans in transnationalism. So that's one thing that I have been thinking about.
Well, thank you so much. From when we met, as we were saying, almost 30 years ago, I've always learned from you. We've not been in touch often, but it's always been great when we've met up again. We had a lovely drink with John McMurray, I remember, a few years ago in San Diego.
Yes, our friend John.
But of course, I've always been reading your work, and I'm a profound admirer of it. And it's been wonderful both to see you, albeit virtually, and to learn some more about what you're doing. So many, many thanks.
Thank you so much. I always enjoy talking with you, Toby.